A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to HIV Hope and Charity, a podcast series brought to you by TVPS, a charity that's been supporting people affected by HIV since 1985. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Jess, and we work for TVPS. And our aim is to get as many people as possible HIV educated. If you like the podcast, please rate, subscribe, and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome, drum roll, to HIV Hope and Charity.
Hello.
I have no idea what kind of edition it is, so I won't try and announce that part.
Oh, okay. And we're looking at history rather than one specific hero this week.
History.
Lovely.
That's from the theme tune if people are just listening to this episode.
Not that you just sing random words.
No, that's not it. So what kind of history? Well, obviously HIV history, answer my own question. But more specifically, what's the subject matter?
One day I'm just going to say, no, nothing to do with HIV. I thought we'd do 80s fashion this week. I've just carried on with an American theme. I've gone very American the last few weeks.
That's true.
And this week is no different because we, as I said, we're not looking at history. No, we are looking at history. This is an excellent start. We're not looking at a specific hero. Sometimes I think, oh, you'll edit all that out. And actually, it's probably impossible.
Oh dear, what is happening?
It's probably impossible to edit all the errors. You'd just be there your whole life just in the little editing suite.
This is probably going to blow people's minds, but it actually takes me ages to edit our podcast, so they're probably all sitting there going, they definitely don't edit this, the amount of nonsense they speak. And it's like, oh no, this is heavily edited.
Is that just because of me? Because I can't speak, I'm inarticulate, and I actually don't appear this week to know what we're doing.
It's more I just did it there. I'm going to leave that one in. We both say a lot. See, so I edit those out as much as possible because no one wants to hear 25 minutes of earning. We also, I needed it again. That's my go-to. We also use odd phrases. And one of my favourites is where both of us go, yeah.
Oh, no.
So I edit it just so we say it once because the other three, four seem unnecessary.
The best way forward is for me to say nothing and then your editing job is easy.
Yeah, this is it. So thank you for listening, everyone. And that's the end of HIV Hope and Charity today.
Oh, except it's not, just such a tease, Jess. This week we're looking at buyers clubs. So the most famous of these is, of course, Dallas Buyers Club. Famous because of the film of the same name. No surprise to you. I've never seen it.
That is of zero surprise to me. You're correct.
Have you watched it?
I have, yes, I have indeed. I think Jared Leto won an Oscar for Rayon, didn't he?
Okay.
Yeah, but apparently this person, I think they weren't actually real.
In the film? No, Rayon wasn't in, because it's based on Ron Woodruff. I can never say his surname properly, but I think that's how you pronounce it. And yes, in real life, he didn't know anyone called Rayon. That was added into the film.
Right, give it another dimension, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. But he did set up the Dyer's Ballast Club. Excellent.
The Dyer's Ballast Club.
The most horrendous podcast we've done yet.
Embrace it. Let's embrace our flaws.
I don't think there's enough embrace in the world to do that to all my flaws, but we'll give it a go. So, I mean, the easy thing would just be look at the film, wouldn't it? And just read out kind of what happened in the film. But actually, it's based on his life, but it's embellished. So I thought, well, OK, why not just look at bias clubs in general? Because there wasn't just one in Dallas. They were all over America.
I didn't realise that. I had no idea. I honestly just thought it was just the Dallas Bias Club. That was the one there was.
No. So let's start with what they were, first of all. That's probably the best place to start. So in the AIDS epidemic, so we're back in the 80s, which is my comfort zone. Bias clubs were used to smuggle large quantities of non-FDA approved foreign drugs into the United States. The FDA are the Food and Drug Administration. Once they'd smuggled in the drugs, they were distributed to the membership of the club. Members paid a membership fee, usually a monthly cost, to have access to the drugs from the club. So you basically paid your money and you could self-medicate. Now it sounds risky, but as we unpick all of this, you'll see why people were driven to do this. So we go back to the 80s. Oh, you've opened your mouth. Are you yawning?
No, I was about to speak, but I didn't. I'm trying not to butt in. I'm working on myself.
Opening your mouth?
Well, maybe I'm trying to signal to you that I'd like to speak. I should have put my hand up.
Yeah.
Next time, that would probably work better than sat open mouth. So it is essentially drug smuggling. Is that sort of what we're saying? So if someone were caught, it would be a similar. Why were the drugs illegal? Wait, are we going to go into all of this?
We are going to go into
all of this. Ignore me then.
Because on the face of it, yeah, that statement, you're like, what? Why would you import drugs when, you know, it's America? Drugs all over the place. Let's explain. In the 80s, the response to HIV and AIDS was slow everywhere, not just in the UK. We've covered this many times, haven't we? Mm. Where they just didn't seem to take any action to stop the virus from spreading. And it wasn't until the late 80s that the first HIV meds were available. I say meds, plural. I mean, there was just one, AZT. And it had side effects. It didn't always work, but it's all they had. So AZT, it prolonged life, but it wasn't a cure. As we know, there's no cure for HIV. And it was originally developed as a drug to help cancer patients, but it wasn't used because it failed clinical trials involving mice. Does that sound like the mice were conducting the trials? Because they weren't.
Yes, it does. In tiny white coats.
No, they were testing the drug on the mice. The mice weren't conducting the tests.
It was both. Just in a little, like, mice town where, you know, your GP is a mouse.
I'm not buying into this. It goes into a weird world of fantasy that I'm not prepared to enter. So let's look at AZT first of all. It is a little bit sciencey, but not much. Oh, science glasses are coming out.
Only because I've got them on the face now, only because you had said to me yesterday, we were organising when we were going to record the podcast, and Sarah said, oh, it's a bit sciencey. So I made sure, had them ready.
Excellent. We also bigged up our podcast to our boss, Sean. I wish we hadn't done that now.
Right. Well, you don't want him to listen.
Not to this episode.
You don't want him to hear about Mouse Town and my new ideas. No. Just turn off now, Sean. Although it's probably too late, isn't it? He's already heard the start. Yeah. Dyer's Ballast Club, Mouse Town.
Oh, never mind. Okay, so look, AZT, the first HIV drug. It started, or it was developed, I should say, because there was a theory in the 60s that most cancers were caused by environmental retroviruses. And that's because all avian cancers were caused by bird retroviruses. I didn't even realise that birds could get cancer.
All animals get cancer?
I don't know.
Well, you think, yeah. So, and cats and dogs, pets do, don't they? But yeah, you're right. I'd never heard of a bird having cancer, but then I don't know that many birds.
No. How would you know?
Right?
I didn't tell you. Okay, so the thinking is, if bird cancers are caused by bird retroviruses, then human retroviruses might be causing human cancer. But up until that point, human retroviruses hadn't been found. So they found the link between the birds' cancer and the retroviruses, but not in humans.
Right.
And it led to the development of AZT. So they were thinking, this is the line we're going along. If it happens in birds, it could happen in humans. And actually, if it did happen in humans, we need something to combat it. Develop AZT. But obviously, at that time, there were no retroviruses known to affect humans. Little did they know back then what was going to happen in the future. The trials on the mice didn't go well. So AZT was shelved. It just wasn't needed. Couldn't address any illness because there wasn't any in humans. And the mice were affected badly by the trials on them. Now, we know from our World AIDS Day podcast, the one with Francoise Barry-Sanusi,
yeah,
that there was a link discovered between leukemia and retroviruses. Do you remember?
Yes, yes, I do.
So that paved the way for our understanding of what was then called GRID, which later led to becoming called HIV. And it led to AZT being brought back off the shelf and subjected to the usual clinical trials, but this time in relation to HIV. Fast track through the system. It's not a new drug. They've already got to a certain point in the trials. So they knew what they were working with and they filed for patent in 1985. Still 5 years after kind of HIV surface, but still. The FDA approved the drug for use against HIV, AIDS, and a new one for me, ARC, AIDS-related complex.
Yeah, I haven't heard of ARC. Obviously, we've done the history of all the different acronyms, like Sarah just mentioned, GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, and sort of how we moved forward and how HIV and AIDS finally got their name. But yeah, I haven't heard of ARC either.
But it's mentioned under the FDA approval. So yeah, learning all of the time. The length of time for approval from lab to patient was 25 months, the shortest period of drug development in history then. I mean, that's certainly not the case now, not since COVID.
Well, I was actually going to say, wow, that's a really long amount of time. But perhaps I'm saying that because I've lived through the COVID pandemic where it was just like rushed out.
Oh, do you think that's our expectation? When drugs normally need to be tested and approved, it can take up to 10 years. It can take a long time.
You're so right. It's a really long time, isn't it?
But I feel on the back of COVID, we're now going to expect these things to be done very quickly. Any new virus, I want a vaccination instantly.
I'm going to expect the army there, you know, helping sort it out, getting people in line, getting them vaccinated.
So 25 months back then, yes, very quick. To get it from, you know, the lab to the patient. And it needed to be because people were dying. It was subsequently approved for infants and children in 1990. So they had to wait a bit longer, understandably, because they're younger. And I know I'm saying, well, it's not long at all. But I mean, if you're living with a terminal illness, it must have felt like an eternity. You hear that there's this drug in the pipeline that won't cure you, but will help with the side effects, but it's not available to you. And the side effects from HIV, as we know, are horrific. You know, some of the infections they had to put up with that couldn't be treated were awful. During this time, when they after they patented it, gosh, here we go again, more bad words. Obviously, clinical trials were taking place because the next step after testing drugs on animals is to test them on humans. But the trials were on a fairly small scale. And there's, of course, no guarantee if you're on a trial that you're actually taking the medication. You could be given a placebo. Some people weren't eligible for the trials. And for some, the side effects were so bad, they couldn't continue to take that particular drug. So people were desperate, not just, as I said, for treatment for HIV, but also treatment for the infections that they were experiencing on a recurring basis. And they wanted anything to make their lives a bit more comfortable. And that's where the buyers clubs came in. So they grew in popularity in America. And you think, well, why on earth do you even need a buyers club? It's one of the richest countries in the world. What's going on here? But it's to do with volumes of scale. So if lots of people want the same medication, you can buy it in bulk and therefore you're going to get it at discount.
Oh, clever.
Yes, a very savvy decision by those who needed the drugs. And actually, if you think about the choice that they had, it was either to all club together and to source the drugs from other countries where they had been approved, or do you club together and take on the authorities and pressurise them to move more quickly and make more drugs available on a kind of, not on a be easier basis, no, to make more drugs available more widely. My choice, I think, would be just give me the drugs.
I agree. I think actually the second option that you're saying would take a ton of time and might not actually result in anything, whereas you could put that time and effort into sourcing the drugs for the buyer's clubs and get what you need.
So that's why they were needed, is because everything was taking, in their opinion, too long. And if, you know, if you're living within that community, you're losing friends to this awful illness. Even 25 months is too long to wait for a drug that won't cure you anyway. It's just going to prolong your life. So the first and largest buyers club was called People with AIDS Health Group, or PWA Health Group. And it was founded in 1986 by three men. So they're Thomas Hannon, who was an American opera singer, Joseph Sonnabend, who was a South African physician. Did I say that right? See, I'm so paranoid now. A South African South African doctor.
Physician? Is that where we're trying to get to? Oh, dear. It's like posthumous all over again.
Oh, maybe it's just words with P that I don't like.
No, I was the one that got that wrong. You got that right.
Oh, physician.
Physician.
So, I'll start that bit again. Joseph Sonnabend, a South African physician. I still didn't say it right.
Just don't. It's like a tongue twister for you.
So they were Thomas Hannon, an American opera singer, Joseph Sonnabend, a South African doctor, scientist and HIV researcher. He was actually one of the first doctors to notice amongst his gay male patients the immune deficiency that would later be called AIDS. And then the third person was someone called Michael Callan. He was an American singer, a songwriter, composer, author and AIDS activist. The reason I am telling you all of this is to illustrate these clubs. They're set up by professionals. You know, one of them is a doctor, and they're doing what they can to help their communities. Although I know it sounds a bit shady, you're setting up a club, you're taking money off people, you're sourcing illegal drugs. Nothing like that at all. These are people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, more legitimate than it outwardly sounds.
Yes, they're not trying to extort money out of people. You know, they're setting up clubs because they're really frustrated at the slow progress being made to medicate those living with HIV. So other clubs started after that one around America. They're all completely independent of each other, but they would circulate kind of product information around. So they were helping each other out, but they were run separately. So the Fort Lauderdale Buyers Club, they set up a code of ethics. Yes, you've got your hand up.
Sorry, I was just going to say, imagine if they all clubbed together in one mega club, how many drugs they could buy.
This is true, actually. And I bet
there's a reason why. I bet there has to be a reason why, where perhaps it's almost that they could smuggle in a certain amount, but perhaps not the amount for like all of the clubs in America.
Yes, maybe there's the danger that you really are going to bring attention to yourself. Because Ron in the Dallas Buyers Club, he's going over the border into Mexico to bring drugs back and saying they're for his own personal use. And in fact, you can do that if you've, but, you know, obviously he was bringing in larger quantities and then going, yeah, these are definitely all for me. So you're right. The more you try and bring over the border or in from elsewhere in the world, the harder it's going to be to kind of hide that or claim it's just for personal use. So Fort Lauderdale, their buyers club set up a code of ethics that most clubs subscribe to, and it included the requirement that products should be provided at the lowest possible cost. So the primary goal of the buyers clubs was not profit, but providing life-saving services to their members. So they have strong ethical code here that they want everybody to follow, that it is really nothing to do with making money. And in fact, some of the people, I mean, the people sourcing the drugs are putting themselves at quite high kind of risk. Yeah. And I imagine there are probably people that just don't have the money to be able to pay, and other people within the club who do, who are willing to pay a little bit more. Very fair, very equal, all wanting to help each other out. And the buyers clubs had another benefit because they're able to provide advocacy, education, support, as well as information on drug development. So for a lot of people, they're a really valuable resource. I mean, I suppose in some ways, they're like the earliest kind of form of peer support, aren't they?
That really is.
Now, we've touched on this. They were illegal. They're sourcing and supplying unapproved drugs, but only to their members. They're not selling them on the street. And I think, I mean, the FDA kind of turned a blind eye to a lot of activity. I mean, I don't think they'd have had the resource to tackle all of the buyers clubs anyway. Mm. I think it was only if you took really big risks with big quantities of drugs that they would have stepped in. And in the Dallas Buyers Club, you know, he does encounter the FDA when he's bringing drugs over the border. And they kind of choose to believe that, yeah, this is all for personal use. So they're kind of letting him get away with it. So there was some empathy there, I think.
Yeah, like you're saying, I'd like to think that although it literally was illegal, that actually people were understanding and would let some of it slide.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, gosh, if they tried to tackle all of them, because there were a lot, there were a huge number of buyers clubs. If they tried to tackle all of them, they wouldn't have been able to anyway.
Well, can you imagine trying to prosecute someone who's literally saying, I am breaking the law because I am trying to help myself with this medication, help my own health because our government is taking forever and I'm also trying to help these other people. I'd like to think there'd be absolute uproar and protest in the street if someone was arrested for that.
I think there would have been, definitely. And I think for some people, I mean, this is a brand new illness, isn't it, in the 80s with lots of different kind of side effects. And we've got to remember the number of kind of doctors that knew a lot about HIV was quite limited at that time. And I think sometimes the symptoms that they were presenting to their doctors, the doctors just didn't know how to medicate, or possibly were like, well, this is just something you have to live with because you've got HIV. I don't think there was always the sympathy that perhaps there should have been. And that, again, fuels their desire to say, well, if you're not going to help me and you're not going to treat my symptoms, I'll find someone who will because I have no choice.
Exactly that. No other option.
Yeah, so I can totally understand kind of why they chose to do it the way that they did. Now, they don't really exist as much anymore, buyers clubs, for HIV anyway, because meds became more widely available and HIV drug knowledge and knowledge actually about the virus increased. And it did increase at pace. I know some people probably be like, no, it didn't. But when you look at the timeline, it did. So buyers clubs were no longer needed. Different combinations of HIV meds became more readily available. Information sharing about how HIV should be managed became much more commonplace. The pool of clinical experts and scientists grew. And although different strains became resistant to medication, new meds were always in the pipeline. So far fewer people were developing AIDS.
Right.
And therefore, they didn't need to look for alternative medication sources. It was becoming much more readily available through the American healthcare system. But that means that we should never forget the originators of the buyers clubs, because they made a huge difference, including Ron Woodruff, who started the Dallas Buyers Club, because they took the risks in obtaining the medication and they broke the law, but out of desperation. And as I said earlier, I would have done the same. So I totally get where they're coming from. Honestly, it never fails to amaze me how many brave people there were in the 80s doing stuff like this.
It never fails to amaze me every week when we do a podcast, how many amazing and brave people there are that have done the most astounding things in the world of HIV for themselves, for other people. It's just crackers. I say it every week, but I'm so happy we're doing this podcast, even if it's just you and me. I know it's not just you and me because I see our stats. And I know we've got lots of listeners, but even if it was just you and me, I'd still want to do this.
I would too. There's so much I didn't know about not just the history of HIV, even people we featured like now in kind of modern day. So much work going on.
So much. Such a fascinating subject that actually really doesn't get enough airtime on anything. You know, might be a film like the Dallas Buyers Club that's a really big film and then we're talking about HIV for a while, or maybe a documentary comes out. Don't get me wrong, these are all amazing, all fantastic, but then it just dies away again, doesn't it? And sometimes we have to go over the same topics because it's important and people still aren't listening and they're still not learning. So I think we don't always get a chance to, like you'll say, explore people that are doing amazing work at the moment or all the things that have come before. I just can't believe this. Buyers Clubs are amazing.
I know. And although I said they don't exist today, that's not strictly true, actually, is it? Because if you think about PrEP a few years ago.
Of course.
And the difficulties people in the UK had getting hold of it before it was approved by the NHS. That's very similar, isn't it? All working together to find the cheapest ways to buy it.
Yes. And the best ways, the safest ways. Yeah, that's like a modern day equivalent of a buyer's club.
I know. In one form or another, these things do still exist. I was looking at outside of HIV and thinking, well, does this ever happen anywhere else? Because obviously we're a podcast for HIV, so we'll focus on that. But do other people living with different illnesses have trouble getting meds to treat themselves, you know, in the same way that PrEP wasn't readily available? And it's true. So I found this BBC News article that was published in 2019, and it's highlighting a group of people with cystic fibrosis that are working together to source a drug called Orkambi, which was only available at the time from NHS England for certain people on compassionate grounds. But it was known to have a significant benefit for people with a certain type of cystic fibrosis. And they formed a buyer's club to source the drug from abroad. And negotiated with, I think it was a company in Argentina, to get this drug. And again, it was economies of scale. The more people they could get to join their club, the cheaper they would be sold the drug. So it still happens now.
Only a couple of years ago, that is, that's still happening.
Yeah, wow. They were called the Cystic Fibrosis Buyers Club.
Whoa.
I know.
I wonder if they're still going. Well, if they are, we'll obviously put the link up and we'll put the article, as we always do. We always cite our sources. But yeah, we'll put the link up if there's people want to go and look that up. Oh, wow.
I know. So still, even in this day and age, people still have to fight or be innovative in how they source medication that has often been approved in other areas of the world. That's how they know it works.
That's hard. You're already battling with your own health to try and keep fighting even harder to help yourself. Must be so difficult.
So there you go. Oh, I finished on a sad note.
No, it's fine. It felt poignant.
There's everything you need to know about buyers clubs in the 80s.
That was fantastic. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I'm actually going to go and rewatch, because I only watched the Buyers Club, Dallas Buyers Club, when it came out. And that's quite a while ago now. So you've actually inspired me. I think I'm going to go and have a little rewatch.
Oh, well, I should just watch it, shouldn't I?
I mean, I feel like the time has passed, Sarah. I feel like if you were going to watch it, it would have been before we recorded this. I feel like just don't worry about
it. That would have been
it.
A good idea, wouldn't it? Well, I do buyers clubs. Where can I source my information? Not from that massive film that came out a few years ago. No, no, no.
But you know what? I like that you didn't just do it solely on that, because like you're saying, that would have been a really easy option and, you know, a great one. But I love that you didn't. And actually, we've looked at the full history and acknowledged the other ones that existed as well. So well done you.
Thank you very much.
Acknowledging everyone. I like it.
Yes. Creating a lot of work for myself. Well done me.
Thank you so much. I look forward, as ever, to seeing you next week for another amazing episode.
Excellent. I will see you then.
Thank you for listening to HIV Hope and Charity. If you'd like to know more about the work that we do, visit tvps.org.uk. And please like, subscribe, and rate the podcast if you enjoyed it.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.